Okay. Hello, everybody. I'm sorry we're a bit late, but I'll go over so nobody will lose anything. I was first, when WebEx didn't open, I was getting a bit panicky, but then I thought, well, it's all right because we're past the point where people can drop out of the class, so we're all right. Be sure to laugh at that. That's a joke. I must apologize also that I have a bit of cold. I hope you'll be able to understand the lectures all right. But it should be all right, I hope. Now, what we're going to be doing today, remember the plan of the course. You know, we're trying to explain how we can arrive at new truth, given that we have two true premises, how we can arrive at a new truth. And to get there, though, we have to follow a rather circuitous route. First, we have to discuss three basic types of acts of thought. There's concepts, then there's propositions or judgment, and then there's reasoning or syllogism. So we were talking about judgments the last time. Now, we're not ready to go to syllogisms yet. That'll be in the next lecture. But deduction, but we're getting closer. We're going to talk today especially about the laws of thought, which is a very interesting philosophical topic. But before I get into that, I'd like to do a review a bit from last time. Remember, what I'm doing in the course, besides going over some of the points in Joyce, I also want to give you some experience in how to spot fallacies in reasoning, and I selected certain ones to talk about. I remember one I picked last time from Richard Posner, who's a very distinguished federal judge, and he was replying to the charge that if we have judicial review, you know, in the American system of government, the federal courts can declare laws of the states or the federal government unconstitutional. So sometimes critics say, well, this is undemocratic, or this is unfair. I shouldn't say undemocratic, they don't have to say undemocratic. They say that this means that judges who belong to a certain elite can impose their will on the rest of us. Say the judges hold certain values, they can impose that on the rest of us. And I would say I'm not concerned now with whether that claim is true or not. I just want to see the reasoning that how Posner replies to that. He's a federal judge, so how does he reply to that? Well, he says there are problems with democracy. And he says democracy is a means not only dispersing political power and thus protecting the private sphere against invasion by the public sphere, but also of enabling people to enforce their dislike of other people's self-regarding behavior. So what he's doing is saying, well, you know, you can complain about elitist judges if you want, but the democracy isn't so great either. Now, there was interesting, one person, I see he's attending the live lecture, Alan, raised a point in the discussion forum. He said, well, maybe I'm being unfair to Posner in my criticism because this is just one of his arguments. Maybe he's going to reply more directly to the claim that elitist judges are imposing their values on the rest of us. But I think if you look at the book, he doesn't really do that because he pretty much accepts that the elitist judges in some sense are imposing their values on the rest of us. So it isn't that he has a reply where he says, no, you're wrong to say that. It's just that he says there are problems with democracy. So what I was trying to point out the last time was this is a fallacy, a very common fallacy called ignoratio elenchi, which is ignoring the issue. So remember, the issue that he's ostensibly addressing is people say that the court, the elitist judges are imposing their values on the rest of us, and that this isn't a good way of doing things. So what he says is, well, there are problems with democracy. I suppose he's right about that. That doesn't respond to the point that elitist judges are imposing their values on. Again, that, I'm not saying that's a good criticism of judicial review. I think it is a fair one, actually, the way it's in practice applied, but that doesn't matter now. It's just what I'm interested in, again, or interested in this course, is the pattern of reasoning. And so the problem is, either he's right, he shifted the subject to something else, and that's an ignatio lenchi. Now, there's another problem with his response, is not only has he shifted the subject, he's committed another fallacy, is why is it that he starts talking about democracy? Well, he's assuming that if you criticize judicial review, if you say you don't want these elitist judges to impose their values on the rest of us, then you must be supporting democracy. So you're assuming that if you didn't have this judicial review, then all decisions would be made by majority rule. And that doesn't follow. There are certainly people who criticize this judicial imposition of values as undemocratic, but you certainly wouldn't have to hold that that's the only alternative. For example, you could hold, say, that judges should have a power of judicial review, but they shouldn't, they should be very strictly confined to what's in the Constitution. They shouldn't impose their values. You wouldn't have to hold that if you reject this type of judicial review where the elitist judge is imposing their values, that you're committed to democracy. So the fallacy here, again, we're not interested in the particulars of the case, whether he's right or wrong on the issue, is that he's attributed a position to his critics that they very well might not hold. And Joyce calls this a false cause fallacy. In other words, the fallacy is you attribute to your opponent a weak position, usually be a weak position, that he doesn't have to hold, and then you start arguing against that. So you're not responding to what the person actually said, but you're just attributing a position. Joyce gives an example of this. He says, supposing someone argues in favor of the death penalty, someone says he thinks that the death penalty, say, for murder is justifiable. Again, we're not concerned here with the substantive point of whether that's right or not. It's just the person says, I think the death penalty is all right, in cases, say, of murder. But then suppose someone who's an opponent says, oh, well, if you're going to say that punishment is all right, just because it's an effective deterrent, then you'd have to say we should have a death penalty, say, for parking tickets, because if you had a death penalty, say, for somebody getting a parking ticket, it would certainly be a big deterrent to people making parking violations. So see, what's being done here is an example of a false cause fallacy, because the person who favors the death penalty need not be committed to the view that deterrence is the only criterion for punishment, so that if something would, even if it would deter the crime, then you have to pay the death penalty, even if it's some sort of very minor violation. So you see what the point is, that the person hasn't said this, but the one who's arguing against the advocate of the death penalty is attributing to him this weak position so that he can knock that out. He says, oh, well, now we've refuted the argument, but in fact, you just attributed a position to the person that he doesn't need not hold. Now, let me just get this out of the way so I can read what I wrote here. Okay, now, one other thing I want to review is, remember we talked last time about how we classify propositions that are universal, affirmative, propositions, a proposition like all men are mortal, all S is P. And then we have particular affirmatives like some S is P, like some men are mortal. Now, these are called I propositions. So one thing to be very careful about, because this is sometimes a bit different from ordinary language, is if you say some S is P, this does not rule out all S is P. So if I say some men are mortal, it leaves open all men are mortal. So the A proposition is left open. Now if you look, take it the other way, suppose you have an A proposition, then this implies the corresponding I proposition. So all S is P implies some S is P. And as I mentioned last time, this isn't true in mathematical logic. In my mathematical logic, you would take the universal affirmative, wouldn't be saying that anything exists, that would mean you would be taking it all S is P, would be interpreted as if there's any S, then that S is P. So it doesn't imply there is any S, but just as if there is any, then it's P. So that doesn't imply that some S is P, because there might not be any S. And if you say some S is P, that does imply that there are some S's that exist. It's just a way of taking mathematical logic. Now one thing, maybe I should have mentioned this last time. I mentioned the difference between the Aristotelian scholastic logic that Joyce is using, we're learning in this class, and this modern mathematical logic. I mentioned this difference between how they take all S as P, whether it implies some S as P. Now it isn't, this difference doesn't suggest that one of the two systems is wrong. It's just different ways of interpreting the propositions. You can set up whatever conventions you want as long as they're useful for you. So it isn't that mathematical logic is wrong and this system is right or the other way around. They're just different ways of understanding what's going on. And so just to go over this again, sense already, but you know, it never hurts to say it again. At least I shouldn't say never hurts, but it's not a, sometimes doesn't hurt. I remember in my greatest teacher at UCLA was Walter Starkey, who was, I probably mentioned before, he's a very time I took him, he's quite old professor. He'd been professor at Trinity College, Dublin. So once, after he gave a lecture, started his lecture, a student put up his hand and said, "You're giving the same lecture as last time." And he said, "That's the trouble with you Americans. You don't, you never want to hear the same thing twice." So, let's go over this. You say all men are mortal. This implies some men are mortal. Remember, this is in the Aristotelian system, not in mathematical logic. All men are mortal implies some men are mortal. And some men are mortal leaves open all men are mortal. Now this is the part that's a bit tricky, because in ordinary language we frequently don't do it that way. Often we don't say some if we can say all. I give an example. I wouldn't say some U.S. presidents were older than 35 if they all are. Of course, they all have to be, because it's required by the Constitution. But so, in ordinary language, if you say some, you very often wouldn't say it if you can say all. But that isn't a requirement of logic, it's just the convention of ordinary language. So, you have to be very careful to distinguish between what's logically implied and what you would be likely to say in certain circumstances. Just in passing, there's a very famous 20th century philosopher, H.P. Grice, who was concerned with these kind of what he called conversational implicatures that aren't strict logical implications, but are kind of conventions of language. For example, supposing I say I didn't kill anybody since the last lecture. It's a perfectly true statement, but in ordinary language, that would suggest that I have killed people. If I've never killed anybody, I wouldn't say I haven't killed anybody since the last lecture. So conversationally implied, if I say that, that I've killed people, but it's not a logical implication. So one thing to watch out for is make sure when you're thinking about these things, when considering what implies what, that you're concerned here with a strict logical implication, not what is when certain statements would be said in ordinary language. Now, I now want to get into a very interesting, I think, philosophical topic that's really the center of our lecture day, and this is has to do with the laws of thought. Remember, we're concerned, what we're trying to do in this course is establish how do we come up with truth from new truth, how do we get from some truth to other truth. So we have certain, as you will see next time, we have certain ways of deducing new propositions, new true judgments, given we have true premises. But the way the system works is we have to follow, the logical system has to follow these laws of thought. If you don't follow laws of thought, then that's going to really ruin everything. So it's important to know what they are. And every judgment has to follow these laws of thought if we're going to make use valid inferences with that judgment. So if anything violates one of these laws of thought, then we know it can be ruled out just on grounds of logic alone. For example, as I'll be explaining shortly, two contradictory propositions can't be true at the same time. So I can't say it's true now that I'm giving a lecture in logic, and it's also the case right now that I'm not giving a lecture in logic. Both those couldn't be true at the same time. So if I'm given this contradiction, I can just say, well, there's something wrong there. I don't have to go out and investigate. Is it the case that I'm both giving a lecture, not giving a lecture? I don't have to do any checking, empirical checking. If I said I'm giving a lecture, then you'd have to see, well, is it giving a lecture? But if it's a contradiction, you know it can't be true. Now, so these laws of thought, it's extremely important we know what they are. Now, Joyce contrasts these logical laws, these laws of thought, with what he calls metaphysical laws. Let's say the metaphysical laws are laws that apply to reality other than thought. So the laws of thought are ones that apply both to reality and to thought, but metaphysical laws apply to reality other than thought. So now, here's a difference, and this is one, I see somebody's put a comment here, Daniel has a very good point that sometimes people take advantage of these conversational implicatures, and they'll think that you can use them to make misleading suggestions, misleading inferences. I mean, misleading suggestions to people that, well, and then you can say, well, I didn't strictly say that, but just in the conversational relations, you would suggest that this, but it's not strictly implied. That's a very good point. But anyway, there's a contrast Joyce makes between logical laws and metaphysical laws. Here's an example. Suppose we say every event has a cause. Say if something happens, like I'm now drinking some water. That was an event, my drinking the water. So that has a cause. So that's what Joyce calls the metaphysical law. Now, why is that? Well, if that law is true, I have to come up with some argument for it that would be making certain claims about reality. Say, somebody could say the notion of an uncaused event doesn't make sense. The and I'm not saying that's a correct view, but somebody could argue that way. So you come up with kind of general philosophical views trying to defend that. But let's compare that with every effect has a cause. That's it's just an application of a law of logic, because what is an effect? It's what results from a cause. So if you say every result of a cause has a cause, if you deny that, you'd be contradicting yourself. See, so that would be important to see. What we're talking about is a strict logical law, which applies, you can just figure this out just from the nature of thought. So now that we at least understand to some extent, I hope, what the difference between what we mean by a logical as opposed to metaphysical law, it's one that applies to thought, not one that just applies to reality and not to thought. We have to get now, what do we mean by law? Remember, and Joyce is very careful when he gives his terms explaining exactly what he means. And he distinguishes three senses of law. Well, one is legislation. Say, the government says when you get on an airplane, you have to go through all sorts of odd security procedures. That's something that is legislated. Now, this obviously isn't what we mean by logical law. It isn't there's some supreme court of logic that's decreed these laws of thought. So we don't mean legislation. Now, the second one is laws of regularity of nature. We have scientific laws, Newton's law of gravitation. We have a certain formula about how the gravitational attraction between two particles. That would be an example of a law of nature. And that's not what we mean by what we talk about here and now. Now, what we mean when we talk about a law of thought is a normative requirement, that's to say, how we ought to think, instead of saying these aren't statements about how people actually do think, although people, at least most of the time, do follow these laws. If we didn't, we'd be pretty confused. But there are laws that tell us how we ought to think. Now, I should have put how we ought to think, given that we want to have valid inferences and only valid inferences. So there are ways that we ought to think if we want to think correctly. Now, sometimes we don't always want to do that. Say we're in a hurry and we just need an approximation to the truth, so we might use some way of thinking that wasn't strictly logically valid, but it was good enough for our purposes. But these laws are normative. If what we want is to ensure that we're thinking correctly, that we're sure that if we start off with true premises, we'll get to true conclusions, then we do have to follow the laws of logic. And it isn't, these aren't psychological laws in the sense that they describe how people actually do think. Sometimes people violate some of these laws. For example, people sometimes have contradictory beliefs. Probably if you point this out to the person, he would probably be bit upset about it and might want to revise his beliefs, but people have contradictory beliefs all the time. Now, I see someone has put a comment here, government statutes, well-designed contract, not law. Well, that's a very interesting point. You know, not just I was responding to my example about the TSA, but, you know, that's not the sort of thing we're getting into in this class. That would just be a particular point about, you know, it would be a particular point about current events, but well, all I was doing was giving that to illustrate the difference between legislation and the kind of laws we're concerned. If that example isn't in fact legislation, and I just didn't pick a good example, but you know, substitute whatever law you want that's been passed by the legislature. Now, okay, so we talked about the law of thought. Now we want to go to probably sort of one of the ones that there are three of these. This is one of the most important, it's called the law of contradiction. And this is that contradictory judgments can't both be true. For example, I guess Socrates is mortal and Socrates is not mortal. They can't both be true at the same time. So it's important to realize that this law of contradiction applies only if the meaning of the predicate is exactly the same. Suppose you said, well, Socrates is mortal in the sense that he was a human being who died after a certain number of years. He died, I think, in, what was it, 399 BC. I think I mentioned his last words were, I drank the what? Okay, so Socrates is mortal. Well, we could say, well, Socrates is not mortal in the sense that his reputation has lived on, in the sense that we could kind of have a metaphorical meaning of not being mortal, like Socrates always has a place in our hearts. So in that way, you could say, well, couldn't you say Socrates is mortal in one sense, but not in this other sense? So that doesn't violate the law of contradiction. It's just if you take the two predicates exactly the same sense, that you say Socrates is mortal exactly the same way, Socrates is not mortal, then you have a contradiction. And it has to be the same predicate, same time. Everything has to be the same. It's just one is denial of the other. And how we know that this law is true? Now this is Joyce answers, this is kind of a typical scholastic answer. Well, this is a principle we can directly grasp. It's something like, suppose you said something like, how do you know you exist? Well, you just grasp right away that you exist. So once we understand the law of contradiction, we can just grasp it's true. So, and Joyce calls this the most certain of principles. Now, what would happen if somebody denied this principle? And this isn't hypothetical. There are logicians who have systems of logic that allow true contradiction. So these are called, I think, paraconsistent logics. Graham Priest is one logician who has such a view. So what happens if you deny the principle of contradiction? Now, here we're getting into kind of, this is a bit difficult, so if you don't get this right away, don't worry about it. But if you deny this principle of contradiction, you're in danger of what's called contradiction explosion. I like that name, contradiction explosion, has a nice ring to it. So what contradiction explosion means is if you allow a contradiction into the system, then you can deduce any proposition you want from it. So, and you wouldn't want to have a logical system where you could deduce anything you wanted, like, say, you could take, say, the most ridiculous proposition, like, the world is made entirely of green cheese. If you allow a contradiction in your system, you can deduce that proposition validly. Now, how would you do that? Well, let's say you have your contradiction, which is, let's say, you want to affirm P and not P. You're affirming both of those, P and not P. Okay, so now what we do is we take any proposition we want, let's take this proposition, the world is made out of green cheese. And then we say, world is made out of green cheese or pea. So remember, we call this a disjunctive proposition. So we have, the world is made out of green cheese or pea. So we're given that pea is true, because remember, we're given the statement pea and not pea is true, so it follows that pea is true. So we have, the world is made out of green cheese or peas. Now, this is something, it's a law of logic that given a true proposition, we can have a disjunction with any other proposition we want. That one is also true. You see, because we have this true proposition P, and then we can just say, well, P or this ridiculous proposition, because why is that true? Well, because P is true, and the disjunction just says one, at least one of the two sides of the disjunction is true. So we have P or the world is made out of green cheese is true, given that P is true. Everybody with me so far? Okay, so then we put that as the premise, P or the world is made out of green cheese. Now we can have the next premise, not P, because remember we have the true contradiction, P and not P. If we have a conjunction, we can take either side of the conjunction we want as a premise to say A and B implies both A and B. Again, we're a little anticipating what we're going to be talking about in the next lecture on deduction. I hope you can see what I mean. So we would then have not P added as the next premise. So the first premise is the world is made out of green cheese or P. You know that's a true statement given that P is true. And we have not P. So what follows if you have this disjunction, the world is made out of green cheese or P, then you have a second premise is not P, what follows is the world is made out of green cheese. So you've deduced this completely ridiculous proposition, given you accepted the both sides of the contradiction. So as I say, don't worry if you don't get the technical details of it, it's just called contradiction explosion. It means if you allow the contradiction in your system, you're going to be able to deduce any proposition you want. So if there's some logicians want to allow true contradictions, then they have to add extra rules to block contradiction explosion. So I just kind of just brought that up because I like this phrase contradiction explosion. It's not one Joyce mentioned, it's rather important in contemporary logic. Okay, now let's get up to an easier point. Suppose we take the proposition, if A, then B, and if A, then not B. And I say, this does not, repeat, not violate the law of contradiction. Now, can anybody see why not? I mean, it sounds like it would, because you're saying, if A, then B, and if A, then not B. So why doesn't this violate the law of contradiction? Yes, Justin said, if A is a hypothetical. Yes, that's right. The law of contradiction applies just to what's called a categorical judgment, where say, this is A is B, or A is not B. It doesn't apply to hypothetical. What it's saying is, law of contradiction says, something that exists cannot have contradictory properties. So I can't be both boring and an interesting speaker at the same time, given that I exist, which I'm willing to accept, at least for now. So a hypothetical proposition doesn't say that anything exists. It just says if A, then B, and if A, then not B. So they wouldn't be contradictory unless we also asserted that A exists, and then we would get a contradiction. Now, sometimes people, when they're talking about law of contradiction, they give this argument. Suppose somebody denied the law of contradiction. Suppose somebody said, well, it can be the case that, at least for some propositions, say, let's take an example, it could be, say, that I'm giving a lecture now, and at the same time be true that it's not the case that I'm giving a lecture now. Somebody could say, well, I think that proposition, namely, both I'm giving a lecture now and not the case I'm giving a lecture now, might be true. So some people would say, well, if you say that, if you're denying law of contradiction, then you also have to affirm it. And why do they think that? Let's say, well, suppose you say law of contradiction is false. So then if the law of contradiction is false, don't you also have to say the law of contradiction is true because you're saying law of contradiction. You can have a true contradiction, so you also have to affirm then you can't have a true contradiction. So is this a good argument? A lot of people have given this, but it isn't actually a good argument because it would only apply if someone held the view the law of contradiction is never true, then he would be in trouble because of this argument, because it would follow, said the law of contradiction is never true, and it would also be the case the law of contradiction is sometimes true, because that would be an example. He thinks all contradictions are true, so the one that denied his assertion would also be true. But if somebody says there's at least one true contradiction, this refutation doesn't work. Again, this is a bit of an advanced point. Don't worry if you don't get this right away, but I think if you think about it, you'll see it's pretty straightforward. You just have to be sure, because remember, what you're doing, if you deny a law of contradiction, you're just saying there is at least one true contradiction. You need not say all contradictions are true. In fact, those logicians who have systems of logic that allow contradictions wouldn't say all contradictions are true. They just let a limited number in. Now, we now want to get to a related view, which is called the law of identity. And this can be phrased in different ways, like one that the 18th century Anglican Bishop Joseph Butler said, which I like, is everything is what it is and not another thing. So if you say A is A, and those of you who know Ayn Rand's system philosophy will be familiar with that. So whatever exists, or a thing has the attributes it can. Now there's some people who think this is just another way of stating the law of contradiction. There isn't really a distinction there. It's just different ways of looking at the same thing. If you say something can't have contradictory predicates, the judgment contradictory predicate can't be both be true at the same time, that's just equivalent to saying that the thing just has whatever attributes it does have. Again, this seems pretty straightforward. If somebody wanted to argue against law of identity, it'd be hard to know how to reply to it. It just seems something we can directly grasp. Now, I now wanted to mention something you have to be very careful to avoid getting into trouble here. We have this law of identity, which says thing has whatever attributes it has. Now, there's some people, and Ayn Rand is an example of one such person, who think that the law of identity, this A is A, has all sorts of metaphysical implications. We can deduce all sorts of very significant philosophical points from it, and it doesn't appear that we can. I remember Robert Nozick used to say, well, the way the objectivists argue for free will is to say A is A, therefore we've got free will. So I just want to go into a little bit, not that we're concerned here to refute or to argue against objectivism. I did give a course on objectivism in the past, but what we're doing here is I just want to illustrate how we have to be very careful what we say follows from the law of identity. Now, what Rand thought was that aside from human choices, nothing in reality can occur causelessly or by chance. So everything has a certain identity, and nothing happens by chance except for human choices. So she's saying the nature of the end determines what it can do in any given this dictates what it will do. So Leonard Peikoff gives an example. Suppose you imagine a helium-filled balloon. So you say, if under the same set of circumstances, it's possible for the balloon, say, to either rise or fall, say, identical circumstances, that they could go either up or down, then he thinks there'd be a violation of a law of identity. He says, such incompatible outcomes would have to derive from incompatible or contradictory aspects of the entity's nature. But there are no contradictory aspects. A is A. So what's wrong with this? Well, it's a misapplication of a law of identity, because the law of identity says that, or the law of contradiction says that something can't have contradictory properties at the same time. So it can't be true at the same time that a helium balloon is going up and going down at the same time. It's part of the identity of the balloon. It's going either one way or the other at the same time. But that doesn't follow from that. If you were to create exactly similar circumstances, that it couldn't be the case that it goes up one time and down the other. Now, Peikoff has thought of that, so he has his answer. He says, well, if you said that, you said, say, one time it goes up and the exact same circumstance goes down, wouldn't you have to say this derives from incompatible aspects of the balloon's nature, because how could it be that whatever causes the balloon to go up one time causes it to go down on the other occasion? So what he's assuming here, he's assuming the law of causation, he's assuming that whatever happens has to have some cause, and going to say, well, if it has a cause that's determined by the entity's nature, how could the cause operate in different ways? But here, this is the fallacy we discussed called begging the question, because what he's trying to argue is the law of causation follows from the law of identity. He's saying, given we have a law of identity, then we have to say that causes always operate in the same way, or things happen, nothing happens without a cause, and the cause always operates the same way. But if he's trying to show the law of causation follows from the law of identity, he can't assume that to begin with and say this is a consequence of the law of identity. It's only a consequence that he's already assumed that causation follows from the law of identity. But that's just what's at issue. You see, so that I put that in just because it's extremely important not to think that the law of identity really implies anything about what kind of things there are. Just as whatever properties they have, then they have them. It doesn't say they have to have fixed natures or natures that operate in accord with the law of causality. Now get to the last of the three logical laws we talked about, law of contradiction. It's interesting, sometimes people call this law of contradiction, sometimes law of non-contradiction. It's the same law, but they have these two names for it. And then we talk about law of identity, so those are pretty easy to grasp. Now the third one is law of excluded middle, which says that one of two contradictory judgments must be true. So if we take contradictory judgment, Socrates is mortal and Socrates is not mortal, so one of these must be true. Now make sure you've got the distinction between law of excluded middle and law of contradiction. Excluded middle says that one of the judgments must be true, so either Socrates is mortal or Socrates is not mortal. And law of contradiction says they can't both be true. Sometimes this law of excluded middle is called the law of bivalence, and there are some logical systems, fortunately not ones we're going to be dealing with in this course, that deny bivalence. For example, it's called intuitionistic logic denies bivalence. So if you deny bivalent, you could have a proposition that's indeterminate. Suppose we say something like, it rained on the night of March 15th, 80,000 BC over the area that is now Los Angeles. So suppose some people think that, well, there's no way to establish whether it rained then. We just can't figure that out. So then these people say, well, the proposition doesn't really have a truth value. The other view, which is, I think, it's a more commonsensical view, would be say, well, it did rain or it didn't rain on that day. You just don't know about it. But this contrasting view says, well, if in principle we couldn't really establish which one it was, then it doesn't have a fixed truth value, so the law of excluded middle wouldn't apply to it. Now, one thing also to remember about the law of excluded middle is it applies to contradictory predicates, not contrary predicates. Remember, we discussed that in one of the previous lectures, I think maybe both of the previous lectures, that we have a distinction between contradiction and something that's contrary. Say, suppose we divide a genus kind of into several different classes. We say contraries are the classes that are furthest apart. Suppose we say everyone is either beautiful or ugly. You can imagine kind of people ranged in we have people ranged in order from the ugly. Say we start with the Hunchback of Notre Dame, and then we get up to whoever you consider is the most beautiful person who ever lived. So imagine you have this ranking of all the people from ugly to beautiful. So you say, well, everyone is either beautiful or ugly. That wouldn't be an application of excluding middle, because something could be at neither end there. Some people could just be average looking. They're not either beautiful or ugly. But if it's case of excluded middle, then you have contradictory predicates. Well, you said everyone is either beautiful or not beautiful, then law of excluded middle would say, yes, one of the two judgments has to be true, and law of contradiction would say both of them can't be true. Now, we now want to get to, remember we want to apply what we just said about contradictory and contrary predicates. We want to apply this to this terminology I was giving you last time about, remember, we have A propositions, universal affirmative, and we have E propositions, universal negative, I is particular affirmative, but O is particular negative. So the rule to remember is, an A proposition and O proposition are contradictory. So we have, let's take an A proposition would be, all men are mortal. I think every man is mortal. So what would be the contradictory? That will be a proposition such that either all men are mortal is true, or this other proposition is true, and that would be some men are not mortal. So at least only one of those could be true, and one of them must be true. It couldn't be that all men are mortal and some men are not mortal, and it must be that either all men are mortal or some men are not mortal. I suppose you took it as all men are mortal and no men are mortal. Then those two would not be contradictories, and it could be the case, although it actually isn't, but it could be the case that neither of those is true. It could be that some men are mortal and some aren't. So it could be that neither the A proposition, the universal affirmative, nor the E proposition is true. But if it's an A and an O, then one of them must be true because they're contradictory. And similarly, an E proposition and I proposition are contradictory. The E proposition is the universal negative. I give the case, no dogs are evil. That says, there aren't any dogs that are evil. So what would be the contradictory of that would be that some dogs are evil. At least one dog is evil. That would contradict no dogs are evil. So, and this we covered already, an A and an E proposition are contrary. So all men are mortal and no men are mortal. They're kind of the opposite extremes. So it's very important to distinguish between contradictory and contrary propositions. Now we now get to another bit of terminology. Sorry, there's a lot of terminology we have in this lecture. This is one that's very important. We have what's called a distributive term applies to the whole extension of a term. For example, suppose I say all men are mortal, then men is distributive because I said all men, I'm talking about everyone in the class of men. It's distributive, applies to the whole extension, everything that's a man. Well, this proposition applies to, I said all men are mortal. An undistributed term doesn't apply to the whole extension of theory. I should say it need not. You can't tell just by looking at the proposition whether it applies to the whole extension of the class or not. Suppose, again, let's look at all men are mortal. So we know it applies, it says all men, but mortal is undistributed because, say, all men are mortal. We don't know how many of the mortal beings that there are men. It could be that the proposition leaves open that only men are mortal. Everything else is immortal, but it doesn't say that. So mortal is undistributed. We don't know how many of the mortal beings are men. It's very important when we're looking at propositions to figure out which terms are distributive and which ones aren't. So now, in the time left, I want to give you a couple more of these fallacies. You know, remember, I want to devote some time in the lecture just to giving you example of these fallacies that you can find in your ordinary life. You'll frequently come across them. This is from a book by Peter Ubel called Free Market Madness. You can probably tell from the title I wouldn't really like this book very much. But what he says is, because cooking takes less time and labor than it used to, the cost of eating is dropped. This is what I mean when I say that free markets have created the obesity epidemic. Advances in food technology have reduced the monitoring time cost of eating, and these technological advances are all the free market enterprise responding to consumer demand. So what he's saying is, well, a lot of people are too fat now, and the reason they're fat is it's really the free market's fault, because free market has given us all this new technology that food costs less to produce, so now the food is available to us and it's there so that we start eating more. So then he says, he imagines the reply, he says, some market defenders might dispute me on this matter, pointing out the obesity epidemic has only taken off in the last several decades, whereas capitalist enterprise has only been around for at least 200 years. We shouldn't have the only there. So, and then he says, so he gives an objection. He says, well, look, how can you say that the market and new technology the market has created is responsible for an obesity epidemic, because the market has been, and the new technology has been around long before the obesity epidemic didn't cause people to get fat then, so why is it causing to get fat now? And then here's the part, again, we're not considering whether he's right or not about this subject point, but here's where he gets into trouble. He says, but by this reasoning, we'd be forced to conclude that free markets aren't responsible for HDTVs or iPods or aluminum siding, none of which existed at the dawn of time. So what's he done there? Again, this is this our old friend the Ignoratio Elenchi, because what the point at issue is, when did the advances in food technology begin? the objection to him was, well, you say food tech, advancing food technology caused the obesity epidemic, but the food technology advanced long before the obesity epidemic. So then his reply to that is, well, if you deny that free markets are responsible for the advances in technology, then you'd have to deny that the free markets are responsible for all these other advances in technology in other areas. And presumably you wouldn't want to do that. Well, isn't it because of free markets we have all these nice products? So how could you deny that the free market is responsible for the advances in food technology? Like, see, this is just a blatant ignorancia elenchi, because the issue is not whether the free market is responsible for the advances in food technology, or whether the advances in food technology caused the obesity epidemic. So he shifted to something else completely, you see. Now, I want to just give one other example of a fallacy. This is from a book by someone who's actually quite a good economist and philosopher, Anthony DeJeste. He's trying to give a defense of appropriating unowned property by claiming it. He says, well, you can read this yourself, the basic argument is, if you appropriate unowned property just by claiming it, you're not violating anybody's rights, because by hypothesis, the thing is unowned. So suppose I say, oh, well, there's some land out there nobody's appropriated, so I think I'll go out and appropriate it. And you say, no, you can't do that. I have a right to go on that land. You can't take this away from me. So he's saying, look, you can't say that because we postulated the land is unowned, so how could anybody else have any claims to it? So what he's done here is, again, he's beg the question, because he's assuming nobody has rights to unowned property, and that might be a correct view, but it's not one that follows by some sort of definition. Somebody could hold, well, you have a right to go on unowned property, but no one has a right to appropriate it for themselves, but still you have rights to the unowned property. Again, that probably not a good view to hold, but it's not a contradictory one, so he's begging the question. Okay, well, I think at this point I'm going to finish and go to the Q&A. Oh, I see there's some comments. Somebody says, I'm getting hungry. Can we change the subject? Well, you have to resist temptation. You don't want to be part of the obesity epidemic. Okay, so let's go to the Q&A, and please type your question in there, and I'll try to respond or evade your question as needed. Oh, good, the slides are up, but thank you. I was glad of that. Okay, does anybody have anything in the Q&A? So let's see, did I miss anything in the chat? Oh, yes, and Daniel makes some point about how knives invention of knives would count as a free market force. Well, that's an interesting question, but remember, we're just concerned now with this fallacy here. Now, David wants to say, ask, could you expand on the subject of types of law? Well, let's go, that's a good question, let's go over that again. Well, suppose we say, I talked about the law of contradiction, that says contradictory predicates can't be true of something at the same time, in the same respect. So I can't say Socrates is mortal and Socrates is not mortal if I understand mortal and Socrates in exactly the same way in both statements. So say, well, what do we mean when we say that's a law? Well, we don't know that it isn't that, say, the Congress of the United States has passed a law to that effect. There can't apply contradictory predicates the same thing. It isn't legislation, something like this. Say, you can take legislation in broad sense, like somebody is enacted, someone in authority has enacted something. That isn't a law. And it also isn't a law of nature. It isn't something like, well, say, suppose we find out that apples won't grow in a climate where the temperature is below a certain amount. So that's something we would just find out by investigating. So that would be kind of a regularity or a law of nature. A law of thought is telling us how we ought to think if we want to think correctly. So that's what we mean by a law of thought. It's sort of telling us what we ought to do, what we're required to do to think correctly. So that's what we mean by that, a normative law, telling us how we ought to think if we want to think correctly. Now, Brian asked, maybe go over the law of contradiction one more time for clarification and example for P. Well, let's say, suppose we say P, suppose we want to affirm P and not P, so let's take the one we already gave. Socrates is mortal and Socrates is not mortal. So we'd be saying P and not P. Socrates is mortal and Socrates is not mortal. So a law of contradiction would be, I can't assert that if I want to think correctly, both sides of contradiction can't be true. Remember, the law of excluded middle says one must be true. The law of contradiction says they can't both be true. Now, Karen says the law of contradiction says that something exists cannot have contradictory properties. Could you elaborate a little more on this, please? Well, suppose, you know, say you say anything exists, like suppose you say my computer screen, my computer is light gray colored. So what I'm doing there, I'm saying my computer has a certain property, namely being light gray colored. So I couldn't say at the same time correctly, my computer is not light gray colored. So what you do with a property, you just put not in front of it, and then you'll get the contradictory property. Or if you have a whole, say you have a whole sentence, Socrates is mortal, you can say it's not the case that Socrates is mortal. So you're denying, that's how you get the contradictory judgment. You deny the first judgment. Sort of contradictions, just kind of putting a not in there, N-O-T, not K-N-O-T. Put a not in, that's how you got the contradictory property. Augustine said, why all men are mortal and no men are mortal are contraries, there's no gradual scale. Well, it's true, Augustine, that's a very good point you raised. There aren't kind of degrees of mortality, like some people are really mortal and others are just partly mortal. You're either mortal or you're not. But the reason they're contraries is, let's say, all men are mortal, no men are mortal, suppose that some men are mortal and some aren't. That's a logically possible state of affairs. So they're contraries because both of the statements, all men are mortal and no men are mortal, could be false at the same time. Let's say, suppose I say all men are mortal and all men are not mortal. They couldn't both be true at the same time. But one says all men are mortal, the other one says all men are not mortal. Well, either the all men are mortal or all men are not mortal. But if you take all men are mortal and no men are mortal, both could be false. They can't both be true that all men are mortal and no men are mortal, but they could both be false, namely if some men are mortal and some men aren't. So contraries can't both be true, but they can both be false. Contradictories can't both be true, and one must be true. They can't both be false. So you see the basic difference there. Okay, now Augustine has another question. Quote from Slide, moral is undistributed. We don't know how many of the moral beings are men. How about all mortals are beings? Well, here mortals is distributed because it says all mortals. But beings is undistributed because it doesn't say, we don't know how many of the beings that there are mortals. Suppose everything that exists, every being is mortal. That would be consistent with the proposition all mortals are beings. But it might be that some beings aren't mortal. So all we know is all mortals are beings. One way of thinking about this is you can imagine two circles. I could have drawn these, but I'm very bad at drawing. So you have a circle of beings, all the beings, and the proposition all mortals are beings would say this: all the mortals are kind of a smaller circle within this larger circle. But it doesn't tell you, if you say all mortals are beings, it doesn't tell you how much of the circle is being occupied by the mortals. So it could be all mortals are beings that. It could be that there aren't any immortal beings, but it could be there are some that aren't mortal. It's left open. Now, David says, law of identity does not apply to human thought. It's just correct. Lots of contradictions in that area. If laws of thought concern the way of viewing the world, what governs how we view human thought and action? Does this take us into ethics? That's a very good question. No, see, the basic distinction there is when we're talking about ought, we say, well, laws are logically normative. This isn't ethical. It's not we're doing something morally wrong if we're violating laws of logic. It just, we won't be thinking in a way that's guaranteed to result in correctness if we violate the laws of logic. So they do apply, laws of identity and the other laws of logic definitely do apply to human thought in the sense that human thought must follow these laws if it's to be reasoning correctly. But the way it doesn't is that if you just take them as psychological generalizations, people could violate them or think in a contradictory fashion. Some people believe contradictory propositions and make all sorts of mistakes in reasoning. So they're not descriptions of how people think. These laws are telling how we ought to think if we want to think correctly. And again, that's not an ought of morality or ethics. An ought of rationality or ought of how thinking in order to arrive at a correct conclusion. Now, as I say, just kind of a little bit of a tricky point, it might be rational in some cases not to follow laws. It's basically extremely important that we come up with a conclusion fast we don't have time to go through the laws, apply the logical laws correctly. We might, in some cases, be rationally justified violating them. I'm not going to get into that because that gets into some very tricky areas. But what we need to do there, in order, in a sense, we have to follow them if we want to be sure that we'll be arriving at true propositions, given the propositions we're starting with. Augustine says, does law legislation have the meaning of a normative requirement? Well, a law is telling us, yes, it's a different sense of norm. It's telling us how we ought to act if we want to act in the way the legislation requires. So suppose you say there's a law that says we have to pay our income tax to the government, then it's saying you ought to pay your taxes to the government if you want to be in conformity with this law. So you could take the law to be normative in that way, but that's not the way we're talking about normative in logic. It's not, we're not required to obey any particular act of a legislature in order to think correctly, you see. You know, remember I started about 15 minutes late, so we still have, if people have more questions, we still have another 15 minutes or so if you want to ask more. We have plenty of time for more questions. Let me see, did I miss anything in the chat session? Oh, yes, Daniel has some comments about government child control programs. I think now that's, of course, a very interesting area. Remember, in this course, we're just concerned with the structure of the arguments, not particular points. Now, Augustine says, from the previous lecture, you said that being in two different places at the same time does not contradict laws of logic. Being in different places raises a question about your identity, right? It must be a split in your identity, I think. Well, I didn't exactly say that. I reported that as the view of my great friend, Father James Sadowski. And what he said was, suppose you say, you're in Romania, right? Suppose I said, I'm now in Los Angeles giving this lecture. At the same time, I'm in Romania, say, at your house. So is that a logical contradiction? Now, what Sadowski says is, no, not that he thinks that that can happen. But he says, well, the logical contradiction would be, I'm now giving the lecture in Los Angeles, and at the same time, I'm not giving the lecture in Los Angeles. So if you say, well, I'm in Los Angeles and at the same time in Romania, he says that's an additional step. You say, well, nothing can be in two places at the same time. That isn't strictly a logical contradiction. Maybe that's a metaphysical law that you can't have at all. Well, he doesn't think that either. But all he's saying is that it's something added to the law. It isn't a strict logical contradiction because you need an extra premise to get to the conclusion that I couldn't be both here in Los Angeles and in Romania at the same time. I have to add something. So if you say, well, it must be a split in your identity if you're in two places at the same time, that would show that, and I don't think you're wrong to think this, that you find it very plausible to think that no one can be in two different places at the same time, but that's a different point, whether it's a logical contradiction. So from the point of logic, it wouldn't be, if Sadowski's right, and again, that's a question you might want to think about, it wouldn't be a split in your identity. You'd be fully in one place and fully in the other place. So the question is that a logical contradiction? He says, no, it isn't. I didn't commit myself, but that's what he said. I think he has at least a reasonable argument for it. It seems like you have to add something to get to the contradiction. Oh, good. Now we still have about another 10 or 11 minutes. I hope my lecture hasn't been too awful, because you probably noticed I just came down with a cold, so it's affecting my voice, but I sound terrible anyway, so it probably doesn't matter that as much as it might otherwise. I've been getting calls from, I'm not giving you the Sadowski story, I've been getting for the past few weeks, I've been getting a call from him every day, usually about 6 in the morning, to make sure I get up early. Okay, anybody have anything else? Now, does everybody understand contradiction, explosion? That was a bit difficult. But does anybody want me to go over that again? Okay, Keith, let me go over it again. Okay, well, let's take a contradiction. Socrates is mortal and Socrates is not mortal. So suppose I claim this contradiction is true. It's true both that Socrates is mortal and Socrates is not mortal. That's what the claim is. So then, well, suppose we have this is a conjunction, Socrates is mortal, Socrates is not mortal. So then, if we have a conjunction, that means we're making a claim for any conjunction. Conjunction is true only if both parts of the conjunction are true. So from Socrates is mortal and Socrates is not mortal, I can deduce Socrates is mortal. Okay, so far, I hope we have Socrates is mortal and Socrates is not mortal. It follows Socrates is mortal. Now, I take any absurd proposition I want. Okay, the example, the moon is made out of green cheese, or the entire universe is made out of green cheese. So we have, remember, we deduced from the contradiction, Socrates is mortal and Socrates is not mortal. Socrates is immortal. Now, we can now form a disjunction, which is Socrates is mortal or the entire universe is made out of green cheese. So is this disjunction true? And the answer is yes, because as long as we have a true proposition, we could join anything else we want to it and get a true proposition, because disjunction is true just if at least one side of the disjunction is true. So we're given Socrates is mortal is true, so it follows Socrates is mortal or the universe is made out of green cheese. So then we write that down. Socrates is mortal or the universe is made out of green cheese. Now, remember, we asserted the contradiction, Socrates is mortal and Socrates is not mortal. We claim that's true. So we can also deduce from that Socrates is not mortal, just as Socrates is mortal, Socrates is not mortal, and follows Socrates is mortal. We can now deduce Socrates is not mortal. Also true. So now, what happens, and again, this is anticipating what we'll be talking about next week in the later lectures. What happens if we have as our first premise, Socrates is mortal or the universe is made out of green cheese? You know, Socrates is mortal or the universe is made out of green cheese. And the second premise is Socrates is not mortal. What follows from those two premises? You have the disjunction, Socrates is mortal, or the universe is made out of green cheese. Second premise is Socrates is not mortal. What follows from that? Remember, the disjunction, one of the sides has to be true. So the premise is saying, well, it's not true that Socrates is mortal. So then it follows that the universe is made out of green cheese. The other side of the disjunction has to be true, because otherwise the disjunction wouldn't be true. So we can get anything we want, given that we accept a true contradiction. That's called contradiction explosion, so it's very important to be able to block that if we want to have a system that allows at least one contradiction. And I don't know why you'd want to allow such a system, but there are contemporary logicians who do have systems like that. Wait, someone wants to know what's my opinion, the best way to train yourself in catching fallacies. Well, I think just read different articles and see if the conclusions make sense to you, and then if you think they don't, try to figure out what's wrong with it. You know, if you read carefully over a number of these, you'll be able to spot some of these ones I've been talking about. But we have time for a few more minutes, I think. Another 5 minutes or so. Anybody have anything? I hope my voice will be back. I won't say normal next week, but at least as close to normal as I generally come. Now, Cursory says, wouldn't the concept mortal lose its meaning? How would you mean that? I'm not clear what you have in mind there. Maybe you could write something about that. Now, Keith says, I found an old, I'll get you the question in a second. Keith says, I found an old school geometry book which suggested that Alice in Wonderland was having excellent examples of logical fallacy. Yes, it does. Remember, the author, Lewis Carroll, real name was C.L. Dodgson, was himself a logician, and he wrote books on logic where he gave very good examples of logical fallacy, so he was really expert. So I mean, Christopher is asking, I think, a very interesting question. Suppose we have contradiction, or we say Socrates is mortal and Socrates is not mortal, both are true at the same time. He says, well, what would we mean by mortal there? Wouldn't that be losing its meaning if we assert both sides of a contradiction. Well, I don't think so. I mean, mortal would just mean what it ordinarily means, living for a certain span of time. So it's important, this is why your question is an excellent one, that a contradiction is not the same thing as a meaningless statement. Suppose I said something like, Socrates, mortal, up, down. Well, that really wouldn't make sense. What am I claiming there? I'm not making any clear claim. But a contradiction is different from a meaningless statement. The contradiction doesn't violate any rules of how work, the meaning of words. It's just claiming that contradictory properties apply to the same thing in the same respect. So contradiction and a meaningless statement are two quite different things, but it's very good that you raised that point. It was an excellent point. Well, maybe we have time for one more. Anybody have any last question? Well, okay then. Thanks very much. Hope to see you all next week. And thanks for coming to the lecture. And next week we'll be talking about how we actually engage in reasoning. We've gotten the preparatory stages. Now we're going to go to some of the actual reasoning next time on syllogisms. Okay, thanks everybody.